All right. Well, good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to be with you again here on this Lord's Day and to spend some time together looking at the Lord's Word. And I appreciate the reading. We'll come back to that specific account involving Saul and the Amalekites later on in my thoughts this morning. Now, compared to the other kings of the Old Testament, the reign of King Saul is rather a singular one. And I wonder if it's because of this singularity that his reign is oftentimes Saul is dismissed as nothing more as a transition in the history of the nation of Israel, moving from the judges to the lineage of David, or he's dismissed as nothing more than a careful what you wish for type of moment for the children of Israel and their demand for a king. But I believe most often we dismiss King Saul as nothing more than a heel to David, someone to provide him, as we discussed this morning, an opportunity to prove that he was a man after God's own heart, provide him an opportunity to shine and, in some ways, drive his narrative, so to speak. And while I believe it's true that David or King Saul serves those purposes, he serves to teach that lesson to the nation of Israel, and he serves to provide David an opportunity to shine, as we read about in Scripture, when we reduce King Saul's reign to being about only those things, we effectively make his reign about other people only, about the Jews and about David, and we really fail to find any room for ourselves in there, find any room to apply lessons from his reign to our own lives. And I think that's a tremendous shame for a couple of reasons. For one thing, I don't believe that the Lord intended for his reign to be dismissed as nothing more than a transition without giving any thought to ourselves. And in some ways, it reminds me of how certain people look at the Old Testament and dismiss it outright as having no utility for us. They believe that Christ served as effectively a do-over, and that therefore the Old Testament and the Old Law has no purpose for us. It has no utility, and we can't learn anything from it. And when we dismiss King Saul's reign, again, as just a transition, we do something similar. And we're obviously aware of the ridiculousness at dismissing the Old Testament outright is having no application for us, because we can clearly see how it's intended to teach us about the Lord and his will for us. And at the same time, I believe that the reign of King Saul serves many of those same purposes. The second reason that I think it's such a shame to dismiss King Saul's reign is because when I look at King Saul's shortcomings, when I look at his struggles, I see myself there. I find him to be an incredibly relatable figure in that sense, certainly compared to the other kings of the Old Testament. When I look at the wicked kings, I really fail to see myself in their struggles at all. I fail to relate to them much at all in any way. I can't relate to worshiping idols. I can't relate to subverting the people's faith to maintain power. And I definitely can't relate to the idea of sacrificing my own children to some sort of false god. And even many of the quote-unquote good kings of the Old Testament, I have a difficult time relating to them and their struggles. I look at David, I can't really personally relate to adultery and effective murder. But I can absolutely relate to feelings of being overwhelmed at being called by the Lord. I can certainly relate to failing to trust in God when things get difficult, failing to really trust in his will for me rather than putting my own thoughts and my own wisdom, as it were, ahead of him, and failing to really trust and lean on him rather than my own understanding. Things which, as we'll talk about this morning, and as we can see, Saul was guilty of. And in that sense, I find Saul to just be someone who is incredibly relatable to us and someone who we can learn a great deal from. So this morning, that is what I would like to spend our time looking at and discussing. The reign of King Saul, what we can learn from it, and what we can apply in our own lives. And to do that, I want us to take a look at four different moments in the reign of King Saul that I believe clearly demonstrate four distinct shortcomings or failures of Saul that I think we can learn from and ask ourselves, if we're not careful, if we can be guilty of them as well. And for each one of those, I would like to spend some time taking a look at how David, time and again, shows us what the Lord expects us, what the Lord would have us to do in those same situations. Like I said before, I do believe that Saul provided David an opportunity to be that man after God's own heart, but I find a great deal of utility, and I find a great deal of personal application when we compare Saul to David, because in many ways, that's the same as comparing our own fleshly nature to what God would have us to do. And a bit of a disclaimer, I don't intend on this to be a character study of Saul. I don't intend for this to be an entire study of the book of 1 Samuel. Rather, that I believe by focusing in and honing in on those moments, we will find the most utility for ourselves in those particular shortcomings. And that's where we'll be able to find the most personal application. And this isn't easy. I think one of the reasons that Saul's reign is often dismissed as well is because when we look at the quote-unquote bad guys of Scripture, we really don't see ourselves there at first glance. I think oftentimes we dismiss them and don't believe that there's much to be learned from them because we're not like them. And I specifically picked this topic. I specifically chose to look into this because, again, I believe that we can all be guilty of the same things that Saul was. At least I know that I personally have. So before we really dive in, though, I would like to provide a little bit of context here. I suspect that the majority of us are familiar with King Saul, but for those of us who aren't, King Saul's reign came at the very end of the period in time of Israel's history known as the period of the judges. And during this time, they did not have a king, but rather individuals would, appropriately so, judge over the nation of Israel and lead them. And this period in time was really marked by a great deal of instability in the nation of Israel. It was marked by a great decline, and I saw many scholars refer to this as the Dark Ages of Israel's history, if they were to have one. Because really, the children of Israel never connected the dots between the fact that their struggles and their failures as a nation and the decline of their culture was tied directly to the Lord's frustration with their sinful ways. And so, this period in time really is marked by just a decay in their spiritual practices, a decay in their culture, and really just a great deal of struggle and abuse from their neighboring countries. And so then we see the last of the judges, the prophet Samuel, emerge in the book of 1 Samuel, which also contains the entire recorded history of King Saul. And we read in 1 Samuel chapter 7 about how upon the return of the ark, Samuel encourages the children of Israel to put away the idols, rededicate themselves to the Lord, and the people come together and do so. But this act of coming together in this manner draws the attention of the Philistines who come out to fight them. And after Samuel makes an offering, the children of Israel end up having an incredible victory over them. For them, what would have been tremendous victory, an incredible surprise victory. And that in that act, they're able to recover many of their lands even from the Philistines. And for them, this was a huge moment. This was them pushing back against all those years of them suffering and having to suffer at the hands of the Philistines. And so then we read that it says there at the end of that chapter that Samuel judged the nation from that point on. But when we move into chapter 8, we read there that some time has passed, Samuel has grown old, and that his sons were known to be wicked. And this put the people in a bind, at least in their own minds, because again, they did not connect those dots between their sinful ways and the struggles that they faced because of the Lord's frustration with them. They believed that their success or failure as a nation was tied to whoever was leading them. So therefore, they looked at the prospect of being led by Samuel's wicked sons with fear. They were afraid of backsliding, going back to where they came from, that period in time of struggles, losing those lands, and they didn't want to go back there. So they take a look around, they look at all the nations around them, see that all those nations who have, again, abused them for all those years, that all of them have kings, and they decide that they need a king. And they put that demand upon Samuel. And this was a major misstep for the children of Israel, one which the Lord acknowledges in verse 7 of chapter 8. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." The Lord then instructs Samuel to warn the people about what their conduct of this king that they desire, what that conduct would be. But the people remain undeterred. And we see their response in verses 19 and 20. And make note of this verse, as we'll come back to these later on in my thoughts. But there it says, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, that we may be like all the nations, and our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" And it's into this situation, then, that Saul emerges. And I think that backstory is important, because I think the position and the recent history of the nation of Israel, and what they wanted a king to do, what their expectations for that king were, are important because I believe those weighed on Saul repeatedly, as we'll see. Saul is then introduced in chapter 9 and verse 2, reading, referencing Saul's father, a Benjamite, and he had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upwards, he was taller than any of the people. We read then how he encounters Samuel in verses 15 through 17. Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, "Tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people, because their cry has come to me." So when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, "There he is, the man of whom I spoke to you. This one shall reign over my people." So then Samuel then anoints Saul commander over the nation of Israel later on the next day in chapter 10, but he does so in private, because it's then later on in chapter 10 how we read that Samuel calls all the nation of Israel together. He tells them to come forward by tribe and by clan so that they can pick this new king for them. So we read about how the tribe of Benjamin is chosen, the family of Matri is chosen, and finally, of course, Saul is chosen as the king, the first king over Israel. But when he's chosen, Saul's nowhere to be found, and the people search for him, and no one can find him. And the Lord has to eventually tell them that Saul is hiding amongst the equipment. And this is the first moment, the first shortcoming of Saul that I would like to give consideration to, because I find this moment to be just a tremendous misstep and a tremendous shortcoming of Saul's. Because think about what we've discussed so far. Given the history of the people, given the history of the nation of Israel, and their total failure to connect their sinful ways with their struggles, the opportunity for Saul to come in and do tremendous things for them was certainly there. Israel needed a spiritual leader. They needed someone to come in, take up the mantle, take up what Samuel had done for them, and continue that on, to provide them that spiritual leader that they so desperately needed. And when this opportunity presents itself, when he has such a chance to do so many things that the Lord would want for the nation of Israel, he literally hides from it. And it's just such a tremendous shame. And, you know, I don't know if Saul viewed, perhaps this was driven by his views on his standing. I know he comments about how he's a part of the smallest tribe of Benjamin, or if he just felt this moment was too great for him. But it's clear that he just didn't understand that this was a moment to be embraced. This was an opportunity from God, and that if he had trusted in God, then he would have sought him through in this moment. And as easy as it is to laugh at King Saul here, and it's a rather humorous story about him hiding from this, I wonder how many times in my own walk I've been guilty of the same thing. How many times when an opportunity has presented itself to me to serve the Lord, that I've hidden myself from that I've shunned away from it. How many times the Lord would have had to tell you where I was when there was an opportunity to serve? My mind is really drawn to when I first became immersed and I joined the body at Smart Road. I had no intention on being involved in the mutual ministry. I had made up my mind on that, and I made excuses to myself, I made excuses to others, and I shied away from that opportunity to serve to such a great degree. It reminds me so much of what Saul went through here. And reminds me of the man we read about in Luke 9 and 59, the man who told Christ, "Let me bury my father, and then I will follow you," because the challenge that he faced, same challenge that Saul faced, and the same challenge that we all face, there will always be reasons to turn our backs from opportunities to serve. There will always be opportunities that seem better served for someone else to do, seem better served for someone else's talents rather than our own, and ultimately we need to understand that those opportunities are ones, again, we need to embrace. They're ones we need to trust in the Lord when we have that opportunity. Now, as I alluded to earlier, I think that David really shows us the way here. He really shows us that what we need to do, what God would have us to do when these opportunities are presented. And one that really comes to mind, because David, more so than I think perhaps anyone in Scripture we read, relished the opportunity to serve the Lord, relish that opportunity to be a spiritual leader, to try to do what the Lord would have him to do. And I think that's demonstrated by his early relationship with Saul. How shortly after David was anointed to be king, that Saul asked for him to be a part of his court. And you could see how this might be questionable to David. It's not clear if Saul knew that he had been anointed by Samuel, but eventually he became aware of it. He acknowledged to David that he knew David was to be king instead of him. And so for David, you can see how this may be a questionable ask, how this may not be, in his mind, the best thing for him to do for the Lord, how him serving the man he's meant to replace may lead to some conflict. And that proved true, as it wasn't that long after this that Saul sought his life. But we see no hesitation from David. And to the contrary of what we would expect, it says that David loved Saul. Because David looked at Saul as the Lord's anointed. He looked at that as his service to the Lord. And he sought to help Saul in any manner that he could. And I find it to be such a powerful example about embracing those opportunities to serve when we have them, even when we know that they are going to be difficult, even when we know that they will lead to uncomfortable, difficult, and at times, painful circumstances. Now, the next moment that I would like to look at in Saul's life is contained in 1 Samuel chapter 13. You can feel free to turn there, but it's a passage that I believe is familiar to us, because here we see that Israel comes out to fight the Philistines after Saul attacks one of their garrisons, and that in response, the Philistines bring out a tremendous force, an overwhelming force for the nation of Israel. And that we see very quickly, Israel's army begins to scatter. The people begin to hide, the people begin to flee across the Jordan, and so we pick up in verse 8 with Saul's army crumbling around him, and it reads, "Then he," referring to Saul, "waited 7 days, according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, 'Bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me.' And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. And Samuel said, 'What have you done?' Saul said, 'When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, The Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled, and offered a burnt offering.' And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you.'" Now, I believe we can all, in many ways, empathize with what Saul was going through here. I think it only would have been natural to be afraid in this moment of what he was facing. But ultimately, Saul was facing a choice between trusting in God, even in the midst of a difficult circumstance, or giving into fear and trying to lean on his own understanding. And although Saul obviously chose poorly, when I read this, I question if I would have had the courage to do any differently. I would have liked to believe that I had been strong in this moment and trusted in God, but given how many times in my own walk that I've given in to sin and temptation in the face of such less adversity than what Saul was facing here, I question if I would have had the courage to do so. I think about the number of times in my life that I've caved to sin and temptation because of pressure from whether it be friends or coworkers or whatever it may be. And what is that in comparison to what Saul faced here? And how many times have we all done that? How many times have we all given into sin because of circumstances being difficult? Because we feel that we don't see an easy way out. And it's so easy to be in a difficult circumstance, to not see that way of escape, and to in that moment give into fear and lean on our own understanding. Or to approach something we know is wrong and convince ourselves that the Lord's standards are just too great for us, or that they don't apply to us in that moment. Again, as to my shame, something I've been guilty of many times in my walk. Yet again, we see David showing his qualities, showing us what God would have us to do. And I think it's most typified by David in 1 Samuel chapter 24, when David has the opportunity to take Saul's life. We talked about how David embraced serving Saul, but here we see that Saul at this time has been persecuting David. He's been hunting him down with the intent on killing him. And here, Saul's life has fallen into David's hands, and he has that opportunity to end his suffering, end his own persecution that he's been facing. And if there was ever an opportunity to apply worldly wisdom, this would have been it. Because all David would have had to do was look at this and say, "I am the Lord's anointed. I have been anointed to replace Saul as king. So if I have to kill him to make that happen, clearly that's what the Lord desires." That would have made sense. But we see that David spares Saul's life, saying twice afterwards, "Let the Lord judge between me and you." Because again, David looked at Saul as the Lord's anointed. So David in that moment chose to not give in to fear, not give in to temptation. And I find this just to be such an incredible example of David's understanding of what we all must embrace, which is, again, that idea that even when things are difficult, we need to lean on the Lord then, not in our own worldly thinking. Now, the next moment in Saul's life I'd like to discuss is the one contained within the reading, and thank you again for that this morning. And really what we see there in chapter 15 is in many ways the opposite of what we saw in chapter 13. Rather than facing an incredible force, a seemingly insurmountable challenge with a crumbling army, here the battle is in hand. The Lord supports Saul's in his efforts to go down and destroy these people, and the Lord just gives Saul one stipulation. He says, because of Amalek's prior persecution of them, the fact that they attacked the children of Israel when they left Egypt in Exodus chapter 13, as we read about there, that they must be entirely wiped out here, that they must be completely destroyed, as the Lord predicted prior in Deuteronomy 25. And we see then that the battle goes well, the Amalekites are destroyed, and yet it says that Saul and the people spare King Agag, the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, and the lambs, and as it says, all that was good. And because of this, Samuel tells Saul that the kingdom is going to be torn from him. And to me, this is an even more frustrating event than what we read about in chapter 13, because here, there is no crisis. Here, things are going fine. Things are going well, in fact. And for some reason, Saul chooses to ignore a direct command from the Lord. And he chooses to lean on his own worldly wisdom. He clearly thinks he knows better than God here. Perhaps he was considering their relative weak position, like we had talked about, the fact that these animals may have been important to them as a nation that had been beat down for so long. Or perhaps it was just simple greed, but I also wonder if perhaps it was true what he said in verse 15 and 21, that in fact the people saved these animals to sacrifice to the Lord. And that certainly seems like an excuse made up after the fact, and it certainly doesn't explain why King Agag was still alive, but I find it interesting that here Samuel doesn't address this as a lie, rather he addresses this head on and provides a rebuke in verses 22 and 23 that I find sum up Saul's shortcomings so well when it reads, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king." Rebellion is a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is iniquity and idolatry. Consider that for a moment. Saul wasn't an idolatrous king, but here Samuel is telling him he may as well have been one because of his rebelliousness, his lack of his obedience, and his stubbornness. And I find that rebuke, brethren, to be a terrifying one. I find that to be a scary verse because of how easy it is to succumb to these same things. Because when we consider it, this sin of taking what the Lord has commanded us and going a step beyond that, that goes on every day, all around us. That is going on in many churches that proclaim to follow Christ this very moment today. Man looking at what God has commanded us to do and taking it a step further. Taking it a step further and saying, "I know better." Whether it's our assembly, our service to the Lord, the church itself, it's so easy for man to look at it and decide to go a step further, whether it be in the name of efficiency or effectiveness or outreach, things done seemingly in the name of the Lord, things that seem noble. But if you substitute those things for burnt offerings and sacrifices, in verse 22, it becomes clear that the Lord desires, the Lord demands obedience above all else, even things seemingly done in his name. David knew that. I believe that's one of the main reasons why David was called a man after God's own heart. Because how many times, like we talked about this morning, do we see David seeking to understand what the Lord wants him to do and then doing it? In my preparations for this and going through 1 and 2 Samuel, I was struck by the number of times we see David do that. The number of times that he goes to the Lord seeking to understand what the Lord wants him to do, and then he goes and he does it. Or how many times in the Psalms we see him praying to the Lord to understand his will for him. And David wasn't perfect in this. As we're aware, I know there's a couple times where I think we can see him clearly coming up short here. When it came to the moving of the ark and when it came to his desire to build a temple, it's clear that there are times, those two times in particular, where David went beyond what the Lord would have desired, perhaps in the name of doing something a little more grand. But we see that David learned his lesson, that when the ark was moved the second time, it was done the right way, and that he ultimately stopped the building of the temple. He basically set that aside for his son Solomon. And although he wasn't perfect, as no man other than Christ here on this earth was, I think that David showed just such a tremendous understanding of what Samuel said here to Saul in this chapter, that God desires obedience above all else, even things that we believe will please him and things that we believe are done in his name. Now, the last event I would like to look at this morning in the reign of King Saul is one that we almost completely associate with David, which is the event of David and Goliath. Now, in chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, we read there about how the nation of Israel has come out against the army of the Philistines, and that famously Goliath comes forth, and his tremendous size is described along with his armor and his weapons. And then we read in verses 8 through 11, "Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, 'Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us.' And the Philistine said, 'I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.' When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." We all know what ultimately happens here, that David fights and defeats Goliath, and that this is his moment. But this moment absolutely should have been Saul's. Saul should have been Israel's champion. We previously read how he was the tallest, he was the biggest in all the nation of Israel, and that people loved him for this. Samuel 10, 23 and 24 read, "So they ran and brought him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upwards. And Samuel said to all the people, 'Do you see him who the Lord has chosen, that there is no one like him among all the people?' So all the people shouted and said, 'Long live the king.'" So this was their guy. And this was the exact moment they wanted a king for. Think back to the verses I alluded to earlier, chapter 8, verses 19 and 20, where they told Samuel, "No, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." So this was Saul's moment. This is what he was literally and figuratively built for. And this is what the people loved him for, why they wanted a king. And when the moment arrives, Saul doesn't stack up. Saul's not big enough. He's not strong enough. Because ultimately, the people put their faith in the wrong thing. They put their faith in Saul and his worldly abilities. And ultimately, that wasn't enough to overcome the world. And it didn't have to be this way. If Saul had just trusted in the Lord, it could have been him defeating Goliath instead of David. But what this demonstrates, what this ultimately shows us, is that we cannot overcome the world with worldly things. We cannot defeat the world with our worldly attributes. We cannot defeat science with science. We cannot defeat intellectualism with intellect. We can never be smart enough. We can never be eloquent enough. We can never be convincing enough. Because when we put our faith in those abilities, those things, we cannot overcome the world. The only thing that allows us to overcome the world is our faith in the Lord and His Son crucified. Those other things will ultimately only disappoint. And I understand that those things have utility. I understand that those things help us in our own walk and our conversations with others. I know at Smart Road, Brother Rick Sparks gave an excellent talk just a couple weeks back about how we can see science demonstrate to us and show us that the events of the flood were true. But I worry, brethren, that it's very easy for us to become too dependent upon these things, to lean too much on them and allow them to influence ourselves and others more than we should. Because none of those things, whether they're our abilities or someone else's, or whether it's science or whatever it is, none of those things can create faith in other people, nor they should be the basis of our own. And that idea, though, of leaning on the Lord and having faith in Him rather than our own or someone else's worldly abilities is, again, typified by David, and in this instance, right in this very moment. Because when David heard what Goliath had said, the blasphemy that he had spoken against the Lord, he said in verse 26, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And after this, after expressing his desire to kill Goliath, that David is promptly chastised by his brother. He's promptly dismissed and discouraged by Saul and ultimately mocked by Goliath. All of them doubting his abilities. And for good reason, because from a worldly perspective, there was no reason to think that David could defeat Goliath. But David didn't have a worldly perspective, nor did he lean on his own abilities. Because we read in verses 45 through 47, "Then David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you, And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. David knew he wasn't delivering Israel. David knew it wasn't his abilities. He knew it was the Lord. And that is where he chose to place his faith. That's the perspective, brethren, that we must have. That we cannot place our faith in our own abilities or the abilities of anyone else, because ultimately those things will disappoint. But that we must place our faith in God. And just like David, we'll be mocked for this. We'll be mocked by those who doubt us. Those who doubt God. But ultimately, we need to remember what we read here. That the Lord does not save with the sword, or with the shield, or any ability that I or you may possess. But that ultimately, the battle is the Lord, and that is where we need to place our faith. Those are my thoughts this morning. I appreciate your time and your attention and consideration to this. I hope that you found these words to be edifying and that these might provide you something to look at and reflect in your own walk and perhaps consider how we may be able to lean more on the Lord and his understanding and his will for us, even in times of difficulty. This time, we extend the Lord's invitation as we sing the gospel hymn. And if you're ready to dedicate yourself to the Lord, if you're ready to move past your own understanding and embrace his own, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing the gospel invitation song.